This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Earth came into being about 4.5 million, I think that's a B for billion years ago. And it's been spinning around the sun ever since, all 5.97 billion trillion metric tons of it. And all of us read that or something very like it in our elementary school science book, and with any luck we remembered the numbers when they came up on the test. But Bill Bryson had a different reaction. He wondered how they know how old the Earth is. How did they figure out how much it weighs? The answers weren't in any of his textbooks, but the questions nibbled away at the edge of his brain. In the years since, Bill Bryson established a fine reputation as a writer with the books A Walk in the Woods about the Appalachian Trail and In a Sunburned Country, an Australian travelogue. Then Bryson decided to tackle what he calls his outstandingly dumb questions about science. He began with, how did we get here? We, meaning human beings, and here, the planet Earth. The answer required an epic intellectual journey through time and space and the history of science and a 500-page book titled A Short History of Nearly Everything. Bill Bryson is with us in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I wonder, was this a project that began a little bit more simply and kind of ran away with itself?
Exactly. I knew it was going to be, by my standards, a fairly big book. But my starting point was, I knew enough to know that our existence as individuals is a pretty amazing thing. I mean, just it has always struck me as quite extraordinary that in the whole universe, atoms never get together and create living objects except on this one planet.
So far as we know.
So far as we know, and you don't have to look very deeply into yourself in the mirror to realize that you're a fairly extraordinary creation. And my idea was really just, how did I get here? Why here on Earth, and what were the stages that were necessary? And as I started reading around and asking questions and looking into it, it became increasingly evident to answer a question like that, you don't go just back to the start of Earth. You have to go right back to the start of everything, to the creation of the universe and the Big Bang. And so it became slightly, not by design, but just the way it worked out, it became a book about trying to understand almost everything.
Of course, the start in the beginning, that'd already been used. You had to come up with something else.
I did, yes. I did indeed, yes.
But it struck me as a friend of mine and I once were trying to design the ultimate recording studio, and we began to realize that, you need to protect your sources of copper for the wiring, so you need to control chili, and then eventually you come to the conclusion you need total world domination before you can actually ensure that you will have the state-of-the-art recording studio, and this book sort of feels the same way.
Yes, precisely. It was, it was more of a case of one thing leading to another than I had ever dreamed of. It was great. I mean, it was hugely stimulating. It was a lot of fun, and it was such an indulgent exercise. I could go into a library and I could look at anything, and as long as it was not fiction, it was relevant to what I was trying to find out. I mean, so I could look anywhere, and I was trying to write a book that was not really a conventional book about science, because first of all, I'm not a scientist, and I have to be very careful how far I can go into a lot of fields because I get lost very quickly. It was more a social history of science, so looking at science from that kind of an outsider's perspective. Mm. And I was looking for different things. I mean, not for really a true understanding of the intricacies of particle physics, but more about the history of the people who were involved in the things.
And almost the politics of science in a lot of respects.
Well, indeed. I mean, I didn't realize that, but there's an awful lot of bitchiness in science. There's a lot of backbiting, and it goes on even now. I mean, probably right now, I think perhaps the liveliest field of disputation in science is to do with human origins and by what means we came out of Africa and how we spread around the globe. I mean, there's an awful lot of... You don't have to talk to paleontologists who deal with human anatomy and physiology for very long to realize that there's an awful lot of ill will towards other people there.
Mm-hmm. I was just reading last night about the dispute going back, not in paleontology, but in terms of looking for dinosaur bones. This was an incredibly important question in deciding how old the Earth is, one of the questions you raised at the beginning of your book. And there were two American scientists who started out as friends, went out on an expedition together, and then spent the next 30 years despising each other, and ratcheting this up.
It was wonderful. I mean, the story is just wonderful. It has made a book in itself several times, but it was a man named Othniel Charles Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope, and they were both amateur enthusiasts. I mean, they came from well-heeled backgrounds and could afford to have their own small armies of diggers, and they were incredibly competitive, worked very, very hard to find stuff, and did anything they could, not only to increase their own stature in the community, but also to undermine the work of the other. And it was one of the nastiest but also kind of delightfully interesting episodes in paleontology.
One group of diggers throwing stones at the other.
They actually sank to the level that they were throwing rocks at each other, yes.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And we have an email challenge this hour. What are your outstandingly stupid questions about science? Our email address is totn@npr.org. And one of the ones that you begin with, Bill Bryson, early in your book is, you're talking about you start with the Big Bang and everything, but you come to the question of, well, you know, you come to the end of the universe, what would you see if you came to the end of the universe and stuck your head outside the curtain, and what would be there?
Well, I mean, this is a question we've all asked at some time or another. You know, what would happen if you just traveled outward in a straight line? Because everyone knows that the universe is expanding, so what is the beyond? What is out there beyond that? And disappointingly, I have to say, the answer is, first of all, almost impossible to understand in any sort of intuitive way. And secondly, it appears that it is not possible to ever reach the edge of the universe. That because of Einsteinian laws of how the universe is structured.
Don't you hate those
curvature
laws?
Curvature of space and time. And stuff that I can't pretend to really understand in any meaningful way. What would happen is that somehow you would curve around and come back on yourself, and then you would be very perplexed indeed to find that you'd gone to a great deal of effort and spent at least several billion years trying to get out there and only to end up back where you'd started from. The only way I can express it is that the universe is structured in a way that makes it effectively, for all practical purposes, infinite. From our perspective, and once you start dealing with things on that scale, it stops being anything that you can really understand. So the answer, as disappointing as it is to start a book with that kind of information, is that you could never get to the edge of the universe.
Here's an email question we've gotten from Steve Sullivan. At our literary group a week ago, the question came up of how much longer the Earth will be habitable, which broke down into two questions. How long will the sun last, and how long before it engulfs the Earth? Mulling over our beers, we disagreed. Some of us thought millions of years, others billions, this allowing for another intelligent race to evolve if this one wipes itself out. So how long will the sun last, and how long will the Earth be habitable? Is that one of the questions you answered?
No, I mean, I don't directly. I believe that the sun is, if I'm not mistaken, it's about halfway through its lifespan. So it's going to be going for quite a long time yet. These become slightly absurd questions because, I mean, we are so much infants in all of this. We tend to think about, you know, will the solar system and sun survive long enough to, you know, what's going to happen to us when it goes? Well, the answer is, I mean, we've been around for such a short while, it's ridiculous to even ask. I mean, from our point of view, from our present perspective, the sun is as good as infinite and eternal, because it's, you know, I mean, we have existed as organisms for like 5 million years, I mean, Homo sapiens, but as civilized beings, I mean, you're talking tens of thousands of years at most. We have been
some
a meaningful part of
that.
yes, but you take my point. I mean, so there's plenty of time left for us to get good enough to do all the things we need to do to ensure our truly long-term survival. But what we have to do in the meantime really is become a lot better custodians of our own fate. Mm-hmm. We are, after all, the first organisms. Again, as far as we know, the first things that have ever lived that have actually been able to have a sense of wonder about it and have been able to manipulate things in a way that could improve our quality of life and the quality of life for everything else on Earth. And yet, History shows that we do exactly the opposite.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And our first caller is Luke, who's with us from Elkhart, Indiana.
Yes, I wanted to call and thank Mr. Bryson for writing books that are understandable and accessible to the average person. So many books that try to cover a topic like this become so arcane that they're lost on most of us. I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Luke. That was my idea. You know, I can't stress too strongly that I'm not an expert on science. My approach to the book was that was my starting point, was that I knew nothing about science and always felt slightly ashamed of it, of that fact, that I knew nothing about really how I got here and how the planet was put together. And I'd always been slightly mystified that I was so bored and confused by science throughout most of my schooling. I could never quite understand that. It always seemed to me that science ought, at some level, to be really interesting. And, like chemistry shouldn't be boring, as most of us find it, because we are, all chemicals. So it, could hardly be more relevant to our being. And we're always interested in ourselves. So why wasn't science more immediately engaging to most of us? That was the idea of the book, was to look at, first of all, if I could understand things well enough to understand it on my own terms, and then also to see if it was possible to write about that science and how people figured things out in a way that made it accessible to an average reader.
Well, that and the humor just keeps cracking me up. I'm 100 pages into the most recent book, and I'm laughing hysterically at times in the night. My wife is wondering, what in the world's wrong with me?
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to hear you say that. Yeah, I tried to make it entertaining. I don't think there's any reason that it's not a textbook. There's lots of really, really good textbooks out there. I was trying to write something else altogether, and so I'm obviously very gratified to know that you're finding it an amusing journey.
Yes, I'm looking forward to finishing it. Also, whatever you write next will also be excellent, I'm sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the
Thank
call,
you.
Luke. One of the passions, though, you have is for scientists whose work was, for one reason or another, overlooked or glommed by somebody else. And tell us, for example, there was a man at the early part of the last century, Mr. Lowell, who had a great theory about Planet X, the ninth planet, and got a lot of credit when they found Pluto.
Oh, yes. Percival Lowell came from Boston, from a very wealthy family, and used his portion of the family wealth to build a big observatory in Arizona, and the Lowell Observatory. And he's most famous for this belief that Mars was laced with canals that had been built by industrious Martians for getting water from the polar latitudes down to the drier but productive central parts of the planet. And he had this long-standing belief in that, for which he was quite commonly derided. But among other things, the Lowell Observatory, shortly after Percival died in the late 1910s, it appointed a young man from Kansas who was self-taught as an astronomer, a guy named Clyde Tombaugh, to look for this Planet X that you mentioned, which was one of Lowell's other abiding interests, was he had this belief that out there was this massive 10th planet, which was dubbed Planet X. And Clyde Tombaugh went looking for it, and what he found, quite miraculously, was not a giant gassy planet, but a little ice ball that we know as Pluto. And it's so far away that it's amazing anybody could ever find it. And Pluto is just a tiny dot, and to have spotted it in this mighty firmament of stars was quite a miraculous event. And it gripped the nation in a way that we can scarcely conceive now, because it was the first American found planet, and it was a matter of great pride. And this was just during the period of Lindbergh and Babe Ruth hitting 60 home runs and all of these things that made us think that we were spectacularly important as a nation. And this added to that, and it was caused a great deal of excitement.
And Tombaugh, of course, was overlooked, and Lowell hailed as a genius, though it turned out all of Lowell's calculations were wrong.
Completely wrong. Yes.
We're talking with author Bill Bryson today about his latest book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. We're also having an email challenge underway. What dumb questions do you have about science? Really dumb. The address is totn@npr.org. Back after a break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is author Bill Bryson. His new book explores the Earth, space, and everything in between. Join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We want to know also about those blindingly obvious questions that science has never answered for you. Send us an email at totn@npr.org, and we have a couple. How can we see the entire surface of the moon when we look at it, since it's so large and our eye is so small? Maybe we shouldn't have emphasized that dumb part too much. If you can breed a dog as large as a Great Dane or as small as a Papillon, why isn't it possible to keep going in either direction, ending up with a dog as large as an elephant or as small as a mouse?
This is not territory that I'm exactly expert on, but there are. I mean, it's pretty basic in a lot of books that bones can only, you can only be engineered to stand so much stress, and your bones could not support you if you became positively enormous. I mean, it's a physical impossibility for a human being, say, to be 80 feet tall, because your leg bones are not, they couldn't. It's all to do with how much stress a bone can take and how much it can be expanded, and it's just you couldn't make anything that large.
Well, here's one you do address in your book. What makes cells decide to stick together into stuff like plaque and skin?
Yes, I do discuss it in the book, but I can't for the life of me remember now. there is some feature of cells that does make them bind together. And I really do, I promise you, I discuss it in the book, but just because you write a book doesn't mean you memorize it. And I can't for the life of me remember what the component was that holds cells together.
Are you telling us you'll have to read the book to find
out?
I'm
afraid on that one, yes, and probably many others.
Let's go now to Robert, who joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hello, Neil. Hello, Bill. And I'll say hello, Bill, because I've happily supported your efforts by reading first one and then three books, and they are both insightful and delightful, and I appreciate your what you bring to writing.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say.
Well, you're welcome. My question has to do with a program I saw recently, and it's, I think it was Nova, but may have been National Geographic, and it was of a geneticist who had spent many years in the laboratory, and finally had concluded with colleagues that there was DNA evidence of a migration from Africa whereby humans spread across the planet, and it was clearly supported by the evidence. So at the risk of starting the paleontology debate and rock throwing, I wonder if you found out anything about that, and is it, has that question been decided? And I'll say goodbye and listen on the radio.
Well, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. Yes, well, as I said earlier in the program, I mean, there's huge amounts of debate. And one of the things that is becoming evident is that DNA evidence can be used to support an awful lot of different contentions. Because it is, an awful lot of it is based on assumptions. I mean, you are assuming, for instance, that DNA is mutating at a particular rate. And that is really a guess, and people can argue over whether these rates go on at rate A or at rate B, and that will give you, depending on which you decide on, that will give you hugely different results. So there's plenty of room for disparity of views on that. The other thing I thought was very interesting was that I spoke to, in the midst of all this, I went and saw a woman in Oxford who works is a geneticist, an Australian-born geneticist working in Oxford. One of the things she had found was that there are sequences of DNA that show that people left Africa a lot earlier than, if the sequences are correct, show that people left Africa a lot earlier than was commonly supposed. But also these sequences anomalously turn up also in Oxfordshire, in England, that there's a sort of an ancient strand of gene in some people that are living in Oxfordshire. And what her conclusion from all that was simply that we don't know enough to be able to really make these sweeping conclusions that we often make based on the structure and presumed behavior of genes over long periods.
One of the things you got to do in this book was also go and meet some scientists and some people who were investigating interesting stories. And I was wondering if you could tell us about a guy you met in Australia, Robert Evans, the supernova hunter.
So Robert Evans is the most wonderful man. He was a minister in the Uniting Church of New South Wales, which is a Congregationalist church, now retired. But he lives just outside Sydney, and he's an amateur astronomer. And what he's noted for is he finds a particular kind of star called a supernova. Supernovae are very important stars for understanding the age and history of the universe and how it works. So it's an important star to look for. But a supernova is just, it's a dying star. It's an exploding star. But because the universe is so big, when these stars explode, the event is happening so far away that all it registers at on Earth is a tiny point of light in the sky. In other words, it just becomes an additional star in the night sky. And what Robert Evans can do is he can look at 2,000 or so constellations, one after the other, night after night after night, and occasionally he says, he'll turn to one and he'll say, that dot of light wasn't there yesterday. And that's his supernova. I mean, he spots, out of all the stars in the sky that you can see with a 16-inch telescope, which is a lot, He can look at the same constellations night after night, and when suddenly there appears one little obscure dot of light that wasn't there before, he spots it.
Astonishing memory.
Yeah, it's and Oliver Sacks in one of his books put him in a chapter on idiot savants, then quickly added that he's not actually an idiot savant, but he has these skills that are of the same caliber.
Though I gather his wife has some agreement with that first term.
His wife, who was a delightful person as well, said that, you know, that he wouldn't remember his own head if it wasn't screwed on, and that he has lots of failings as a person. You know, his brain is not perfect, but for some reason he has this gift for just spotting very tiny points of light in the sky.
And that story of this man who spends his evenings on this little, you know, my picture of it from your book was a deck off the back of his house, looking through a postage stamp into the sky. Well, maybe a letterbox, I think you'd call it. And that story leads us to the story of a scientist by the name of Fritz Zwicky, who you tell, who's one of these astonishing characters you come up with, who are brilliant, many of them, but, you know, eccentric doesn't begin to describe it.
Yes, Fritz Zwicky was this extraordinary guy who was, he had a very polyglot background. I think he was born in Bulgaria and grew up in Switzerland, and then came to Caltech in the early decades of the 20th century, and was not an outstandingly bright or brainy person, but he was just great at conceptualizing things. And he was the person who came up with the idea of supernova, that he worked out that if a star collapsed to a certain density, then it would explode. It might explode spectacularly. And supernova explosions, they're the biggest event in the universe. They create more heat and action than anything since the Big Bang. I mean, they are really a very important event in the cosmos. And he just, without really any evidence or any basis to pin it to, he just conceptualized the idea that maybe this is what happens. And it was all based on the idea of neutron stars. Neutrons had just been discovered in the 1930s by James Chadwick in England. And so Zwicky was always making these great leaps of imagination, but he was also an incredibly difficult person to get along with, and to the point that one of his closest associates, a lovely, very gentle German fellow named Walter Bader, actually refused to be left alone in the same room with Zwicky at one point, because he was certain Zwicky was going to kill him.
And people didn't like him, so they didn't give him credit for the stuff he'd actually done.
That's right. And he's even now, his work is not fully appreciated. I mean, you will find him now written about in some books, but there was a whole period where his name scarcely occurred in books in the history of astrophysics at all, because people just didn't like him. And he was a very difficult character and very pugnacious, and he was a person who would actually punch you in the nose if he was mad enough, and that, of course, is not an endearing quality in the academic world.
We're going to read some more of our emails of dumb questions about science. Just raise your hand if there's any you want to talk about. I'm not going to pin you down anymore. If you're in a falling elevator, why can't you jump just before it hits the ground and save yourself? All right. Try it if you can. And from Frederica Brown in Fort Mill, South Carolina, what exactly would happen if you flew a spaceship into a gas planet such as Uranus or Neptune? Is there any type of solid ground in there? My three-year-old wants to know, and I can't answer him. I don't know if you can either.
I gather not. I mean, what would happen is the same thing that happened with the comet Shoemaker-Levy a few years ago when, you remember, crashing into Jupiter. I mean, these things, they hit the surface, get into it, and they explode spectacularly. I mean, if you tried to penetrate into Jupiter, the spaceship would be completely demolished long before it got anywhere near the center. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected, because this is not actually territory I stray into, is that it is just a gigantic gas ball and that it is gaseous all the way through.
Here's my brain empty era, writes Diana. If the universe as we know it was created from the Big Bang, what did the pre-Big Bang universe look like? The universe that contributed the compressed matter that exploded to create our universe?
But again, a question we all ask at some point. And the answer is that we don't know, of course. We can't know. We can't know why the universe began when it did. First of all, there was nothing. I mean, there was, it's a state we can't really imagine. It's not just a sort of emptiness. I mean, there was absolutely nothing. And from that nothingness...
Because there was nothing, we can't stand outside of it and look at it.
Exactly. I mean, you can't imagine a real nothingness. I mean, you can imagine a sort of dark emptiness, but this was less than that because there was nothing to be empty. I mean, there was absolute state of nullity, which is a state we cannot really imagine as human beings. And then for some reason... the universe happened. And the amazing thing, I think, is that the universe, I mean, something as big as a universe, it was created in 3 minutes, about the time it takes you to make a sandwich. We went from nothing at all to beyond conception, space beyond conception. It's kept moving out ever since, but, I mean, it was of a universe size in 3 minutes. What was before that, nobody can possibly know. And as I quote one of the scientists in the book, he says that once you start asking questions like that, you're getting very close to religious questions.
And then you get to the term Big Bang, which was coined by a critic of the theory and another one of your beloved wackos, Fred Hoyle.
Fred Hoyle, who was a very crusty and difficult Yorkshireman. Brilliant, brilliant man.
Science fiction writer.
Yeah, wrote some very successful science fiction. But he really deeply despised the idea of the Big Bang. And in the early 50s, the Big Bang was not a universally accepted theory. He believed in an alternative theory known as the steady state theory. And in a radio broadcast for the BBC, he actually coined the term Big Bang as a dismissive, somewhat sarcastic way of describing the alternative theory, which he thought did not make sense and didn't actually hold water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could only be something like a Big Bang. Whoa.
Yeah.
Our guest is Bill Bryson. His new book is The Short History of Nearly Everything. And here are some of today's headlines at NPR News. A Florida court says a $145 billion finding in a class action suit against Big Tobacco was excessive and unconstitutional, and an interim Iraqi government won't be established until mid-July at the earliest. U.S. Civil Administration had planned to create a temporary authority as soon as next month. You can hear reports from NPR's Debbie Elliott in Florida and Chris Joyce in Baghdad later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. We're going to continue taking questions with Bill Bryson for a few minutes, and then later in the program, we're going to have a refresher course in mad cow disease, something that we all studied up on a little while ago, but everybody's forgotten. Well, mad cow disease has now popped up in the North American continent, so we'll bring you up to date and on the story and remind you what it was all about in the first place. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go back to the phones. Bill joins us from Virginia Beach.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Bill, I'm one of your biggest fans. I own every book you've written, and I've just been delighted by the way that you bring the sort of weird and often unmentioned things into the realm of, basically whatever you're talking about, whether it's Australia or the Appalachian Trail or, in this case, science. I was kind of wondering, have you spoken to any educators and whatnot? Because it seems to me that, the sort of things that you fill your book with here, the most interesting parts are those parts that, we never learn about in school. And that human element, that sort of nutty human element that goes on behind a lot of great thinkers and scientific process, you know, that's the kind of stuff that would turn people on to science. And I just think we need more of that in science education today.
Well, thank you very much. And I mean, I agree with you entirely. That's the whole idea of the book, was to try to make, to look into science, try to appreciate what it is that science is and what scientists do and how the clever things they've done, but to do it in a way that isn't really terribly scientific, if you know what I mean. I mean, the book is not, the way I could describe it is if this was a book about automobiles, it's not really about how the internal combustion engine works. It's more about the great racing car drivers. It's looking at it from that perspective. Obviously, it has to deal with the science, but the reason I'm stumbling over some of these questions is because I'm not Mr. Wizard, and I never set out to be. What I'm doing is trying to appreciate what science is about and what scientists have given us and what they still don't understand.
It's that appreciation that science doesn't happen in a complete physical vacuum. It takes people. That's so refreshing about your book.
Yeah, and I truly agree with you. I think it's a shame that more of that human dimension wasn't put into it, because it is, a lot of these people are delightfully eccentric and sometimes even quite wondrously loopy, but they're also often very, very inspiring. And for those of us who are not of a particularly scientific cast, it is a very effective way of getting into the subject. So you can appreciate, when you understand the context of the times, when you understand sort of where Einstein came from, for instance, and how totally unexpected his thinking was in the early, you know, in 1905, and he was just a patent office clerk in Switzerland, what he did then becomes even more magical and special. And that was kind of what the idea of the book is. It's to put things in their historical context.
Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get a question from Joe in Minneapolis.
Hello, gentlemen. My question is, hello?
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, we have the Goldilocks zone that we live in that keeps us safe.
Where everything's just right.
Exactly. I was wondering, is it possible that the formation of galaxies itself has its own Goldilocks zone, where if you move too close in towards the center, you have to deal with the chaos of formation and planets getting thrown out, plus the massive black holes? But then if you move too far outside of the galactic Goldilocks zone, then you have to deal with the fact there's not enough material to make up stars and planets to create formations. Would that have any type of effect on the amount of life that's possible in the universe?
Sure. I mean, it appears. We don't really have much perspective on this because, you know, there's only life in one place that we know of. So we can't really tell what other conditions might generate life elsewhere. We can only go by what we think were the necessary prerequisites for us to be here. And it certainly appears, from what I've learned and have been told, that, you know, we are here because of just an enormous number of things having to be exactly right, everything fine-tuned, from just the matter that was created in the Big Bang and how it was distributed through the universe, and that, you know, atoms were created that have this facility to clump together and form molecules and become slightly more complex. But then for all these other things to happen, for there to be solar systems and for those solar systems to have planets, and sometimes for those planets to be rocky, and sometimes for those planets to be just the right distance from the right size star so that they have water and an atmosphere and so on. All these things are necessary for us to be here now.
Dumb luck, huh?
Yeah.
Dumb luck. All right, we're going to have more with Bill Bryson when we come back from a break. And also we'll be discussing mad cow disease. We'll talk about what it is with the director of the Center for Animal Health and Food Safety and take your calls on that question as well. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, we're going to need your help to write a commencement address. Here's the recipe. We're going to need you to call or email. You can start emailing today. Any phrases or quotes or anecdotes that you think are inspirational, good advice for a graduating class. Then we're going to bring in a speechwriter to help make those ideas cohesive. At the end of the program, we're going to read the address that we have all composed together. So help us write a commencement speech tomorrow at this time. If you have suggestions now for thoughts or phrases or stories, we're going to need an opening joke, you know. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. www.bryson.org. Our guest at the moment is Bill Bryson. His latest book is A Short History of Nearly Everything. And one of the things we've been asking for emails with dumb questions about science, and we're not answering many of them, but here are some good ones. Could you please ask your guest, why is the sky blue? I think the next word in that phrase is usually daddy. That from Doug in Pompano Beach in Florida. And Rebecca Kyle asks, what color were the dinosaurs? I don't know if there was an answer to that. A lot of stuff in your book about dinosaurs. I don't think there was much about color.
Well, no. I mean, they can't really tell this because of anything much about the fleshy parts of prehistoric animals because, the flesh deteriorates and degrades and disappears after the animals die. So, we have to guess very often. But nobody really knows what color the dinosaurs were or what sort of, wattles they might have had or what their ear shapes might have been.
Or what sounds they made.
Yeah, I mean, nobody, for instance, if nobody had ever seen a living elephant, they would be probably very unlikely to guess that its ears were the size and shape they are. Mm-hmm. And even the trunk might be something of a would be something they would miss. Because they would know that it might have a large hooter of some sort, but not necessarily that it would have a long dragging trunk. So all of those things have to be left to the imagination, which is kind of exciting. And if you look at illustrations of things like dinosaurs done over long periods, you will see that they go through fashions where sometimes they're sort of spotted and speckled and quite colorful, and other times they look more like army camouflage. Mm-hmm. But it's all guesswork.
Let's go to Skip, and Skip's on the line with us from San Mateo in California.
Hi. I really appreciate the opportunity to ask this question. It's a serious one, and I have to preface this by saying that I'm a great lover of science, but one of the things I've been fascinated with for a long time is that class of phenomenon that simply may, in the long run, be completely inaccessible to science, for which there may be no answers or for which we can make no predictions. And scientists in general seem reluctant to engage that question very aggressively because those who are mistrustful of science or for various reasons don't like scientists might tend to make inappropriate use of the answers. But nevertheless, I think it's an important one. It's partly philosophical, but also I think a hard scientific question, and that is, has there been work on exploring classes of phenomenon for which there are simply no answers or the answers are unknowable to us? And who's done work on that? And what do you think about that question? And I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Skip.
Right. Well, geez. Yeah, I mean, there's been research on everything. I mean, it would be hard to find a field where there wasn't research. I'm not exactly sure I quite understood where the question was going. But what I can say is that, scientists... often, scientists are human, and one of the things that surprised me in doing the research for the book was discovering that scientists often don't think about a question until they're ready to answer it, and that was a real surprise to me. I mean, if you think, for instance, a question that often occurs to most of us, or many of us, is, what about salt levels in the ocean? Every time water is evaporated from the ocean, it goes up into the atmosphere as fresh water and therefore must leave its salts behind. And we all know that every year sediments are carried down to the seas and there's more salts deposited into the sea. So why don't the oceans get saltier and saltier and saltier with time?
Edmund Halley thought that you could measure the age of the Earth that way.
Yeah, by working out how much was deposited. But the question is, if we're adding all this salt into the ocean every year and if all the water that's evaporated from the ocean is fresh water, then the ocean should be getting saltier and saltier. Scientists really never thought about that question at all, this paradox, until they were ready to answer it, which has happened as recently as 1977 when they discovered these big vents, the black smokers that everybody knows about that were found by the submersible Alvin. And what they discovered was that the vents were working essentially like filters in an aquarium, that the salts are taken back into the earth in a process known as subduction, and the water goes down with them and is stripped of all its salts and then pumped back out through these vents, and it comes back into the oceans as fresh water. And again, over time, you have this remarkable stability, which is exactly the conditions we need the oceans to give us in order to promote life on Earth. Another instance of just how lucky we are to have an environment that supports us. But that is the answer to the question, and as I say, it wasn't, not only was it not known the answer was not known until the late 1970s, but you won't find the question asked anywhere.
Perhaps not anywhere, but in Bill Bryson's new book, which is A Short History of Everything. It's been a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Bill Bryson was with us here in Studio 3A. We're going to end with one last metaphysical email from Dean in Flagstaff, Arizona. If an infinite number of radios are surrounding one radio and all are tuned to talk of the nation, will the one in the middle receive the signal?